We're in the book of Exodus, chapter 20. I've got a sister, 2 years older than me, that when we were kids, did a lot of arguing. And we did a few other things, but mostly we argued. And a lot of the times in our arguments, something would, and I'll just give you kind of an example of something. I may be eating some cookies. And she says, "You're supposed to give me some of those cookies, not eat them all yourself." And or it could be, you know, anything similar to that. And I would, you know, the common refrain is, "Who says? Who says I'm supposed to give you some of these cookies?" And she might say, "Well, name somebody that's our cousin. Our cousin said you're supposed to give me some cookies." I just keep chawing away, right? I'm not worried about my cousin. She says, "Mama said you're supposed to give me some cookies." And that gets my attention. And I'm trying to figure out just what my options are. But they're severely limited to what when it was just my cousin said. Or she might say, "Daddy said." And I say, "How many do you want?" Depending on the person who's she's coming to with their authority depends on my reaction. You see, I've entitled our sermon this morning, "Who Said?" We just went through the Ten Commandments. Took us 3 months or so to do that, going through the Ten Commandments. I want to back up and give you the setting, remind us of the setting for before they were given, and kind of see where we're at now that they're finished. But first I want to give you what I'm calling the big idea. If you have an outline, hope you have a pen. I've left a lot of blanks this morning. If you're going to get one thing from the sermon this morning, here it is, the big idea. Let me give it to you. It is important for you to understand not only the Ten Commandments and what they require, but who it is that requires it. Let me say that again. It is important for you to understand not only the Ten Commandments and what they require, but it's also important for you to understand who it is that requires it. So let's read our text, Exodus chapter 20, verses 18 to 21. The text says, "Now all the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet, and the mountain smoking. When the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. Then they said to Moses, 'You speak with us, and we will hear. But let not God speak with us, lest we die.' And Moses said to the people, 'Do not fear, for God has come to test you, that his fear may be before you, so that you may not sin.' So the people stood afar off, but Moses drew near the thick darkness where God was." Prior to the Ten Commandments being given, God gave Moses instructions for the Israelite people to spend 3 days getting ready for God to come meet with them. 3 days of cleansing, 3 days of personal preparation to get themselves together in a sufficient manner to meet, to encounter the presence of God. God set boundaries around Mount Sinai that the children of Israel were not allowed to go to cross. They could only get so close and no closer. And Moses goes up on the mountain to speak with God. And while he's there, God tells him, "Go back down and make sure the people don't encroach upon these boundaries." And Moses said, "Well, they know, you know what they're said. They're not going to do that." And God says, "Go down there. Go down there and make sure they don't encroach upon it." So Moses goes back down. And while he's down, we come to Exodus chapter 20, where the Ten Commandments are given. presumably, at least in my estimation, the people heard God's voice giving them these commandments. Now, I say that because in verse 19, let's look at it again. They said to Moses, the people said, "You speak with us, and we will hear. But let not God speak, lest we die." So it reads like the implications are, we've heard God speak already, and we don't want any more of that. Right? Isn't that kind of how it seems? All right? So it seems like they heard God's voice, and I assume that that's the way it happened, that God spoke the Ten Commandments in such a manner, in such a way, that all of the children of Israel heard him. So that's where we're at up to this point. Now, on the outline, I've got 5 or 6 points, some on the front, some on the back. Some of them are questions. So let's look at these. The first one is this. What was happening at ground zero? And I'm calling ground zero the focal point of where all of this is taking place. What was happening here in our text? God's just finished giving the Ten Commandments. There is thundering. There are lightning flashes. There's the sound of a trumpet. And the mountain is smoking. I want to suggest to you that this is a little different thundering than what we hear around here. I want to suggest to you that the lightning that they see is a little different lightning storm than what we encounter. Now, there's always going to be somebody, some skeptic, some critic, who's going to come forth and inform us that you can go back tracking astronomy and the track of some comet and find out that in 1200 or whatever BC, on March the 10th, which is probably when this was happening, that there was a particular comet that just happened to make its way across the sky. He did it in the same time there was a full moon and the magnetic north shifted in such a way that there was earthquakes and all this kind of stuff. There's nothing supernatural about it, just a coincidence that this occurred at the same time. They'll always say something like that. But this is far more than thundering. This is far more than lightning. This sound of a trumpet is far more than Craig practicing his trombone. There is something about this that is terrifying. That's what's going on. Number two, how did the people respond? Well, their response, whatever it is, their response is to what they have just heard. Their response is to what they have just seen. How did they respond? Text says they trembled. They backed up. They started backing away. They stood far away, and they say something to Moses. They say, "Moses, we don't want this." This is my paraphrase. "We don't want this. We don't want to hear God speak again. You go to God. We'll stay back here. You go and talk to God, and you tell us what he said. But let us stay back. We're afraid we're going to die." So that's how they responded. So number three, why did they respond in that way? Why did they respond that way? I've got a few questions there. Was it to prevent their untimely death by being in the close proximity of God? Yes. That was one thing. That was why they responded that way, because they thought they were going to die. Verse 19 we saw says that. Were they afraid of the thunder and lightning? Yes, they were. Were they afraid of the uncanny sound of the trumpets continually blaring and sounding? Yes, they were. Were they fearful of the smoking mountain? Yes, they were. And if that had been all that there was, that would have been sufficient reason for them to respond the way they did. But I suspect, in fact, I'm just pretty sure, that there is something far deeper, something far more profound than that, that caused their reaction. And that's what we want to look at. It's important for us to understand not just the Ten Commandments that they have just heard, but it's important for us to understand who it is that's requiring us to obey them. Back page number 4, if it wasn't then for this upheaval of all these physical elements, then what was the problem? What was wrong? I'm going to give you 7 or 8 things here. The first one is this: the convincing awareness of the greatness of God. Over and over again for the past few weeks and months in their trek across the wilderness, they have seen God do some great things. They've seen God do some mighty things. They have seen the power of God. They've seen the terror of God. And the further they go, the more convinced they are, you would think, that this God is a powerful God. He is a great God. Something else that is far deeper than just these physical things. They saw and are convinced of God's infinite power. God has rolled back the Red Sea. God has caused a land to be filled with all kinds of varmints and reptiles. God has struck people dead. God has caused physical things from the sky to come and fall upon the earth. They are convinced that this God is as powerful, more powerful than this earth and all of these things that we can see and imagine. Number 3, they are convinced of His unyielding justice. God has not let anyone slide. God is requiring justice at the hands of the Egyptians, or at the hands of God. The Egyptians are experiencing God's justice. They are being convinced that this God, our God, is a God who is a just God. And that fact ought to make them fearful, ought to make them uncomfortable. I'll tell you how that played out in my own life. When I was a teenager, I went through a number of years where I was a total idiot. I was rebellious against my dad and my mom and just did anything stupid that come along. That's what I wanted to do. Just to get back at my dad, who I had something against him, supposedly. As a senior in high school, you know how you have yearbooks and you get people to sign your yearbook. I had one of my teachers sign my yearbook. And he wrote in it this: "Someday I hope the world sees more of your potential than was shown here." I was proud of that. Shows you what a fool I was. But my dad was such a guy that he was honest. My dad wasn't always right. My dad didn't always, he was not sinless by any figment of the imagination. But his heart was to do right. All of my life, his heart has been that way. But when you're 17 years old and your heart is given to evil. Your heart is given to sin. Being in the presence of someone like my dad was a discomforting thing. I didn't like him being around. He worked off. He worked different places around the state. He was only home on weekends. The closer it got to Friday night, the more I dreaded it. My dad wasn't mean. We didn't fight. There was nothing going on between him and me. It was just he was there. And I knew he could see through me to the depths of my soul. He knew what was in my heart. And that made me extremely uncomfortable. When Sunday night came and he went back to work, I could handle my mom. I couldn't handle my dad. Just his presence. To a large, or as Donald Trump would say, a hugely magnified extent, the children of Israel are experiencing that. They have experienced the presence of a just God. And it is troubling them. It's troubling them so much more than the thunder, so much more than the lightning. They are fearful. The next one is apparent foreknowledge. You pair up foreknowledge with justice and you've got a deadly combination there. God knows it. He knows everything. And then you give these people 10 commandments. This is the next one. The 10 commandments, they are forced to measure their own actions against these commandments, God's undeniable moral law. And they can't help it but compare their own life to these laws. Just like we have done for the last 3 months. You could not help but yourself, but as you listen to the sermons on the Ten Commandments and read the Ten Commandments, you cannot help but judge your own behavior against those commandments. And I doubt if there's one person here this morning or has been here for the last 3 months, I doubt if there's one person who examines their own life honestly would not find that they have broken all 10 of those commandments. Now here's the problem, and this is the next point. When you see the commandments and you read one, okay, here's one about stealing. No one has been able to say, okay, there's stealing. Now I know what that one is, and if I ever break it, then I'll mark it off. No. No one starts off with a blank slate. When we understand the commandment, what do we find? We find that we are already guilty. Already we're condemned. Already the commandments condemn us. There's no use to plead before God that we are innocent, because we're not. We know we're not. He knows we're not. There is nowhere we can hide. There is nowhere we can go to escape His presence. And we feel like, and the Israelites, I'm pretty sure, felt like that looming judgment was upon them. And they were about to die at the hands of this God any second who was there with them. The thunder and lightning pales into insignificance. That was the problem. That's the problem. I want to give you a few examples in the scriptures of people who experienced the same reaction at the presence of God. The first one I want to look at is in Isaiah chapter 6. The first six verses. You can turn there if you hurry, but I'll be reading it. Isaiah chapter 6, 1 to 6. Notice what Isaiah says. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. So here we are again. Isaiah tells us he sees the Lord. Sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above it stood seraphim. Each seraphim had six wings. With two wings they covered their eyes to shield them from the blazing presence of God's glory. With two wings they covered their feet to cover their unholy feet before the presence of God. And with two wings they flew. And one cried to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of His glory." And the post of the door were shaken by the voice of him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke. On a smaller scale, perhaps a personal scale, we see here what the Israelites saw at Sinai. So what does Isaiah say? "Woe is me, for I am undone." Now let's not read that like a stoic Puritan. "Woe is me," right? I don't think Isaiah said that. I doubt if he could hardly get the words out. He says, "I am damned. I'm going to die. I'm condemned. It's not that I'm just going to lose my life. I am punished. I am condemned to eternity. Woe is me, for I am undone." Now, your version may use a different word there. That's okay, but I like that word, undone. Because that word, undone, has that prefix on the front of it, un. Then the word, done. Have you ever been done? Maybe you're done cleaning house. Maybe you're done washing the dishes. Maybe you're done mowing the yard. Maybe you're done as if I've got my act all together. Things are going good. Life is good. My relationship with my family is good. With God is good. I'm done. Perhaps that's where Isaiah was. But when he sees the Lord here, he says, "Woe is me, I am undone." Suddenly Isaiah realizes he's not as done as he thought he was. He is undone. What reason does he give? He could give many, but he gives us one. "For I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips." And he comes back to this. "For my eyes have seen the Lord," or seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Isaiah is terrified at this revelation that he has of God. We go on. In Mark chapter 5. I'll read a verse or two there. Mark chapter 5, verses 25 to 34. Jesus is somewhere out in public, people all around him, and there's a woman there. See in verse 25, "A woman who had a flow of blood for 12 years and suffered many things from many physicians. She had spent all that she had. It was no better, but rather grew worse. She hears that Jesus is coming. She says, oh, if I could just touch him, I'd be healed. If I could just touch his garment, maybe I would be healed from this ailment, whatever it was. So she comes among the crowd, and somehow she manages to maneuver herself in a position where she can reach out and touch him. And she does. And Jesus says, who touched me? And the disciple says, who knows? People all around, lots of people have touched you. How are you going to know who touched you? And Jesus turns and looks at the woman. And notice what happens. In verse 25, the woman, fearing and trembling. Now notice the next phrase. Knowing what had happened to her. Think of this. This woman apparently has just been healed. And she knows it. She can feel it in her body that she has been healed. And what's her reaction? She is scared to death. Jesus looks at her. Surely, someone who has just healed you is not going to have malice toward you. She has touched him, she's been healed, and she is terrified. Mark chapter 5, just back up a page, verse 17. Verse 17. This is the account of a man who is full of demons. Jesus comes to him and casts out the demons, and the demons talk to Jesus. They say, hey, don't send us away, to a far country or whatever. He says, he ends up putting them in this herd of swine. You know the story of the swine run off the cliff. Someone goes to town where there's the nearest group of people and starts blabbing, spreading the news. This Jesus has come and he's healed this guy. Everybody knows the guy. Everybody knows who he is, the old Joe out there in the tombs, and they've healed him. So they come out to see. And they're there. You look at verse 17. After this is all, they see what's going on. They see Jesus. They meet Jesus. Verse 17 says, then they began to plead with Jesus, with him, to depart from their region. Here's a guy, Jesus, who has healed this man. He's done something great, something marvelous. Surely he could do something for me. I've got issues. I've got relatives who need a touch from God. Why not get him to stay? No. They say, would you please leave? Why is that? It's because they realize that they are in the presence of God. And they are troubled, extremely troubled by that. Matthew chapter 17, I'm not going to read this, but at the Transfiguration, you know the account there. Jesus has been with his disciples for a while. And he carries three of them, Peter, James, and John, upon the Mount of Transfiguration. He's there. And they, at that moment, they see such a manifestation of his glory that they are on their face in the dirt, fearful for their life. They've been walking around with him for weeks. Why are they suddenly scared now? Because they got a glimpse of really who he was. Mark chapter 6, Jesus walking on water. Jesus fed, I think he fed the 5,000 and or performed some miracle. And he sends his disciples out in a boat. And they go out there and it's night and a storm comes up and Jesus comes walking across the water to them. They see him, they think he's a ghost, and they are afraid. Okay, now their fear, you might say, is because they think they see a ghost. And you're right. Jesus says, don't be afraid. He goes on up to them, gets in the boat, and then the storm is over. The sea is as still as a mirror. And then the verses say, and then the disciples were extremely afraid beyond measure. They were already afraid of this spook that they thought they saw. But their fear doesn't go away when Jesus comes. Their fear increases. In Luke chapter 5, let's look at this one. Again, this is one of those accounts where we read it, and we read the words in our English Bibles, and we don't get the feeling. We don't get the emotion that's involved there. But Jesus is up by the seashore, and look in verse 5, or verse 4. He says, launch now out to the deep, let down your nets for a catch. Simon Peter says, Master, we've toiled all night. We've fished all night and we haven't caught a thing. Nevertheless, because you ask us to, we'll throw the nets over. So they throw the nets over. When he had done this, they caught a great number of fish and their net was breaking. They signaled their partners to come and help them. They haul all these fish in the boat so much that the boat is in danger of sinking. And notice verse 8, Simon Peter. He's been with Jesus for weeks. He knows Jesus. He's been around him. But all of a sudden, Simon Peter falls at Jesus' knees. He says, please leave. Please go away. What reason does he give? Because I am a sinful man. Would you please leave? Years ago, I heard a sermon, I think it was by John MacArthur. He was talking about the charismatics, the name it, claim it, crowd. And if you've listened to him much, you know he's not a big fan of name it, claim it stuff. He tells a story. I think it was Kenneth Copeland told. Kenneth Copeland, I shouldn't use that name because the name may be wrong, but it's one of those guys, I'm pretty 90% sure it's him, said every morning when he shaved, he stood in front of the mirror shaving, Jesus stood beside him and talked to him. Now, in my opinion, some of these guys have got to out-wow each other. You know, you tell this big story of something that happened, and first thing you know, somebody's got a bigger one. Something God done. And all the people go, oh, you know. Kenneth Copeland says, I was shaving. Every morning when I shave, Jesus stands beside me. And what I remember about that story was John MacArthur's question. He says, I wonder if he keeps shaving. I wonder if he keeps shaving. Now we looked at some of those things we just went through. Point number 5, passages in Mark, passages in Matthew, where people are terrified of Jesus. You might say, and I'll fix and say it for you, for every one account that I just gave you, I can show you 10, 20, the same Gospels where Jesus is there, performs a miracle, and nobody bats an eye. In fact, some people get mad at him, accusing him of being a devil, a demon. Some of them are happy and thankful, but seems to be they're just grateful. There's no fear, it appears, or at least we don't see it from our text. So why are some things that way and some things not? Why are some of these reactions in the Bible, this is not the norm? This fear thing that we see is not the norm. It's not the norm in my experience. So why is that? This is number 6. First of all, think of this. Miracles in the Bible, and this doesn't necessarily prove anything. It's just something that you will notice. Miracles in the Bible happen in clusters. At least that may not be the case, but that's the recorded case. They come in clusters. There are lots of miracles in the time of Moses, the life of Moses. There are lots of miracles at the time in the ministry of Elijah and Elisha. Lots of miracles clustered right there. And there are lots of miracles during the time of Jesus. Now, whether miracles and the manifest presence of God's glory happened that regularly at other times, I don't know. Because the text doesn't tell us, and I wasn't there. So I don't know. Another thing is that we see repeatedly in Scripture that there's this idea that if we see God, we cannot see God and live. If we see God, it's going to kill us. We see different people in the Scriptures that have that fear. Here's my statement. In order for us to, quote, function, in order for us to carry on our business, God, as a general rule, conceals His glory from us to a large extent. You remember when Moses was on Mount Sinai and Moses said, "Lord, I want to speak to you face to face." What did God say? "Can't do it." So God hid him behind a big rock. And God passed by and allowed Moses only to see God's backside as he passed through. I may be fixing to mix up two stories. But I think that was the time where when Moses came down, what had happened? His face was glowing. Is that the same account? Just from seeing a passing glimpse of God's backside. Jesus, when he walked on this earth, perhaps for more reasons than one, did not display all the attributes of his glory with his disciples or any of the time that he walked on earth. There were some things about Jesus that he did not use or display all the attributes that he was. Jesus was not omnipresent. God, we say, is omnipresent. God is everywhere in His fullness at all times. Jesus was not that way when on earth. He was limited to one spot just like we are. I'm not saying He wasn't God. I'm saying He didn't display all the attributes of God. He didn't display other attributes of God. He concealed those things. But every once in a while, for I don't know why, enough of God's glory leaked out, or Jesus raised the veil just enough for whatever reason was His own reason, that people saw enough of God's glory, and the reaction was always consistent. fear and terror. This is the God who gave us the Ten Commandments. This is the God who requires obedience from you to His moral law. This is Him. I've got down to the very last point, a few lessons. Here's the first one. Work. Work at getting a grasp. Or this is something, work means you do it, and you be diligent to do it, and you be zealous about doing it. Work at getting a grasp on the fear-inspiring holiness of God. Come to terms with that fact that God is a holy God, and His holiness is such that it inspires fear in us. The second one, work at getting a grasp on the fear-inspiring unholiness of your wretched heart. We need to see ourselves as we are. We are wretched people. We are sinful people. And you come to grips with that, it ought to terrify you because of who God is. There are a lot of people, and I don't need to be trying to put a number on it or use the word a lot, but there are people who have heard the message of grace all of their life, over and over and over again. They've heard this message of grace. But still somehow, for some reason, they get this idea that I can please God on my own. I can do enough good deeds. I can do enough things that God is going to be satisfied with me. And they are dependent upon their behavior to please God. It's not going to happen. And then the last one is this: in all things and in all states of mind, worship this God. Now we went through the Ten Commandments. We're fixing to start going through a lot of a wide range of other laws. Most of them are called case laws. They're, what do you do in this case? What happens? And you're going to be surprised. You know, we look at the Old Testament, we look at the laws, and we look at all this stuff, and think, oh my goodness. And you got to go through, you know, just wade through all this stuff. But I'll guarantee you, the principles behind these laws you will find useful to you, because they are just as applicable to us today, just a little different situations than they were in those days. Laws to govern and principles to govern our lives. That's where we'll be headed. All right, let's pray. God, would you help us, God, to be convinced of your holy character? God, it's easy to say that and then turn this right around and act as if you don't even exist. God, help us to grow in our understanding of who you are. The depths of who you are. God, help us to love you. Give us hearts that are given to you, that want you. Lord, for your honor, for our desire to glorify your name, we pray. Amen. John, would you get